welcome to the 25th anniversary meeting of the Comics Arts Conference. The CAC, if this is your first panel, too bad you've missed so much great stuff, is a little bit different from the stuff that happens in other rooms at the Convention Center. We're an academic conference. Our mission is to bring together academics and professionals with the public to discuss the medium of comics. What that means is that we're not going to market anything, nor are you getting anything for free at this room, unless you want a program. We have programs dedicated to our panels in the back that look like this. Listed in this program is all of the various different panels and presentations we've had over the course of the week. Also on the back is a call for papers. If you'd like to participate in the CFC or the CAC in the future, this call for papers will tell you how to go about doing that, how to contact us at our website and at our email address. We also have shirts that we do every year. This year's shirt is yellow. That's our 25th anniversary logo. And it's an homage to Wonder Woman. On the back it says, Studying Sappho. These shirts are available, assuming they're not sold out, which is always an iffy assumption on a Sunday, over at the Comic-Con merch booth in the Pacific Ballroom in both men's and women's sizes. If you could silence your cell phones, we would greatly appreciate it. Also, this panel will consist of three separate presentations, so if you could save your questions for the end, that would be very helpful to us. This panel will be looking at, fantastically enough, fangirls. We'll be starting with Angela Tremonti. From the University of Colorado Boulder, followed up by Caitlin O'Shea from Reed College, and finishing up with Angelica Calica from also the University of Colorado Boulder. So I'm going to pass over to Angela.
Hello, can you all hear me? I'm Angela. Yeah, like she said, I'm from the University of Colorado Boulder. If you have questions about my paper, I have to leave after the panel's over, so you can write down my email right now. But my paper is looking at the success of Ms. Marvel, who its fans are, and why it continues to be successful, and now in its like fourth year of print. So basically the idea for my paper came, I was sitting in the audience actually at CU of a talk with G. Willow Wilson, who is the head writer of Ms. Marvel. And if you go online, there's like a TED talk with her. It's a pretty similar talk to the one she gave that I was in the audience for. But she basically is describing her experience when Marvel came to her and wanted to ask her to write Ms. Marvel. And they basically were like, we want you to write this new character, Kamala Khan. She's just a teen girl from New Jersey, Muslim, Pakistani-American, who gets powers and becomes Ms. Marvel. And G. Willow Wilson was like, well, that sounds great, because typically in comics, new characters don't sell, female characters don't sell, and Muslim characters don't sell. So she basically was like, I guess I can do whatever I want. I probably will get canceled. And just like went for it. And as you guys might know, if you follow Marvel Comics, the VP of sales in this April said, what we heard was that people didn't want any more diversity. They didn't want female characters out there. That's what we heard, whether we believe that or not. And he got a bunch of backlash, obviously. This is not like a very good publicity statement. But as a fan, you kind of have to wonder, like, is this true? Are the sales backing this up? Or you kind of hope that, obviously, it's just, like, a bunch of bull. But you kind of are nervous, like, oh, maybe people aren't supporting these comics that we love that are new stuff. So I was like, uh-oh, and I looked just to see. And this, of course, if you follow by Ms. Marvel standards, then this isn't true. Ms. Marvel has been wildly successful over the past 3 years. In its first month after the graphic novel publication for the first issue, it was the number one graphic novel, the number one digital bestseller, and it has, for the past 3 years, been on the New York Times bestseller list. So obviously that wasn't true in the sense that people are wanting this diversity, they're wanting female characters. So you have to like wonder where that disconnect from the VP of sales is coming from versus the people who are buying the comic. And in her TED talk, G. Willow Wilson says, I wanted to create a love letter to the younger millennials who were the series target audience. And if you look through Ms. Marvel, the characters are millennials. They're just young teenagers for the most part. And the people who are buying the comic are also millennials pretty much. So I wanted to look and see why it was successful among them when all odds were stacked against it, and it should have otherwise not been successful. So what I did is I just looked over the first 11 issues of Ms. Marvel. It basically followed the first main story arcs and went through the first defeat of her major villain. And it basically analyzed the comic for, like, in the context for looking for mentions of millennials. And then I did some research on perceptions of millennials, stereotypes of millennials, and how millennials behave, and see what the stats and the data behind that said. And then I looked in the comics to see if it addressed this at all, and see if it compared. So basically, the first thing that I found that was really telling of why it might be successful for millennials is Kamala acts as this hero fan. And a hero fan is someone who exists in the universe where they already have superheroes and everyone is aware of the superheroes. So Kamala is, like, on her computer writing Captain America fanfic. She has a Carol Danvers poster on her wall. She's aware of these superheroes and she's fans of them. And later this hero fan becomes a superhero themselves. And, like, these characters, obviously from DC, but Wally West and Tim Drake, this happened to them too. But as you can see, they kind of don't look like Kamala Khan. They're just like white teenage boys, which is kind of indicative of what people expect for comic fans to look like, but obviously isn't true. So this act of Kamala becoming one kind of opened a platform for other comic fans to see themselves become the heroes that they want to be within the comic, as not necessarily boys, not necessarily white, not necessarily older guys. Who are into the superheroes that they know and love. So millennials just really had an opportunity here to see themselves represented in a way that hasn't previously been done. And then another thing that I looked at is I just did some research about how other people and older generations perceive millennials. And the research came back that baby boomers especially perceive millennials as apathetic, low engaged, they don't really want to vote, they don't want to take in the news, they're lazy and pretty hopeless when it comes to that. But the study shows that although people might perceive millennials as that, they just are engaged in different ways. They have really high volunteering efforts, really high other social engaging efforts. They just not necessarily trustworthy of the news, trustworthy of authority. And I think we can see this in Kamala Khan later. I'll get to that with her first villain. But basically, they have a lot of anxieties about the future that kind of drive them to want to do better and want to do good things for the world, but that might come in ways that are like volunteering as opposed to campaigning for whoever at the voting booth. And this is the first major villain in the series. It is a Thomas Edison clone with the head of a cockatiel, because why not? But I think, actually, this is a pretty scary villain because a crazy dead guy mixed with a bird is, like, terrifying to me. But if you can, like, read the bubbles, he basically is just, like, bashing some millennials there. So we can see kind of the baby boomer perception reflected in him, but his evil plan is basically there's like an energy crisis and an environmental crisis, as we all are probably familiar with, and he basically siphons the energy from teenagers in order to like help renew energy. And the plot twist of the series, sorry, spoiler, but Kamala basically thinks he's kidnapping these teenagers and using them for his evil plan, but later it turns out that they're volunteering to do it. And I think we can see the millennial attitudes reflected there, that they kind of just feel hopeless and like they have nothing to do. I think at one point in the comics, Kamala's like, why are you guys doing this? And the millennials are like, well, we're just like an extra generation. We're parasites kind of leeching off the environment. And we just, like, don't know what to do about the future, so this is how we know how to help. And she basically is just like, no, you guys, we can't do this, but we might not be the ones who made this mess that we're currently in, but we have the opportunity to fix it and to help. And I think that is really telling of why millennials really like resonate with this series, just because not only are their anxieties reflected, but how other people perceive them are reflected, and then it kind of offers a hopeful glimpse to the future about what you can do as a millennial to help with this, and it doesn't have to be hopeless. There can be opportunities to do better. And then another aspect of why it could be successful is that obviously Kamala is not like Tim Drake, not like Wally West. She is reflective of all these different identities. Yes, a millennial, a comic book fan, a teenage girl, but she is also a Muslim American. She also is Pakistani American. And some of these experiences are really, they really resonate with a lot of fans, but some of them are really specific, and a lot of fans don't necessarily share those experiences. But in the research, it shows that millennials still value experiences that they don't necessarily relate to. The first panel and the first page of the comic, it opens up with Kamala, and she's sniffing bacon, a bacon sandwich, and she really, really wants this bacon sandwich, but she can't have it because as a Muslim, she isn't allowed to eat pork or bacon. And this obviously is a really specific experience to others that share that religion, but at the same time, I think a lot of millennials can relate to wanting something that they can't have. And this is why this is a brilliant piece of writing that millennials want to read. They want to experience new outlooks on life. At the same time, they can still relate to it and they can still understand these points of life. And we haven't really seen that often in comic books. And that's why it's successful and people are in love with Kamala Khan. And we like really see this come through in this striking panel. When she first gets her powers, she's allowed to like transform with the Terrigen mists allow her to do this, and she changes into her idol Carol Danvers, who's now Captain Marvel, and she obviously doesn't look like Kamala Khan. She's tall and blonde and Brie Larson, if you're going to see the movie when it comes out. But that obviously doesn't look like Kamala Khan, and she realizes over the course of first like two issues, I think, that this being in this form, because she's just really freaked out, and this is what she knows a hero to look like, she realizes that it's really draining her energy, and she's not very powerful when she's trying to keep this form. So both metaphorically and literally, she learns that she is the most powerful version of herself when she's being herself. And that's just a really striking millennial experience, because I think with the media, just the onslaught of images and beauty, especially for teen girls, this is obviously a problem that many are not seeing themselves reflected in magazines or on TV or in any kind of pop culture. And when they see this, like, this person exists and they can be a hero, but you, how you are, can also be a hero. So basically, G. Willow Wilson, she says the trend these days is to suggest that the world is moving forward in spite of millennials. I would like to suggest that the world is moving forward because of them. And I think this just really sums up the success of the comic. It's clear that she wrote it for millennials and with millennials in mind. And I think that the sentiment is just reflected within the comic, and that's why it continues to be successful, despite the fact that nobody thought it was going to be successful. And obviously, the VP of sales might disagree that these diverse stories aren't successful, but they are. So, thank you. What do I do now? Let me unplug it.
Just, here, Caitlin will give her paper, so just go ahead.
Hello. My name is Caitlin Alfay, and the title of my work is This Must Not Be the Place for Me, Gender and Inclusive Practice in the Comic Book Industry and Fandom. For my research, I studied the experiences of women in the comic book industry and fandom. Specifically, I examined the ways in which female fans and industry members have been made to feel excluded in fandom and industry spaces. With this focus, I hoped to illuminate the ways in which exclusion and harassment persist in comic spaces, with the ultimate goal of understanding how we can make these spaces more inclusive. I focused on comic book shops as sites of fandom entry, and compiled a list of comic shop practices that make female fans feel particularly excluded or included. For today's presentation, I will focus on this aspect of my research. My list of practices, which I will elaborate on later in my presentation, includes practical steps comic retailers can take to make women and similarly marginalized groups feel more welcome in their shops. Ultimately, these practices would help lower barriers to fandom entry, making comics more accessible while making retailers more money. For my data collection, I visited comic book shops, attended a women-centered fan convention, Geek Girl Con, and conducted 10 interviews with women who read, sell, or create comics. In my presentation, I will be referring to respondents by their first names. Some respondents' names have been changed for logistical purposes, though they all consented to their names being used. Because this research was done for my undergraduate thesis, my time and resources were limited. As such, my interview sample size is not as large as it would have been given the ideal level of resources. So, while I do draw conclusions based on my data, I recognize that my findings may be limited in some respects. Now, on to my findings. Many of the women I interviewed and heard speak at Geek Girl Con discussed comic book shops as points of entry into the fandom at large. One panelist at Geek Girl Con explained that, while she had wanted to read comics at a younger age, her first experience in a comic shop was so negative that it deterred her from reading comics for several years. Given this example and the general cultural prominence of comic book shops, it is essential that we examine common experiences women have in these spaces. I asked each of my participants to describe the ways in which these spaces are gendered and what specific traits make them feel more excluded or included. One respondent, Anya, indicated that the average comic book shop, quote, already feels gender neutral, unquote, to her. She went on to clarify, quote, I've never experienced anybody being rude to anyone else, whether it's female or male. For me, I've never felt it's never felt uninviting, but maybe I just assume that's my place, unquote. Anya's response is encouraging, as it shows that some women have never felt excluded from comic book shops. However, Anya's experience was in the minority of my sample, and as such, it remains necessary that we examine the ways in which comic book shops feel gendered for other female enthusiasts. When discussing the markers of welcoming and unwelcoming shops, employee behavior was the factor most cited by my respondents. Karen remarked, quote, I could care less about the other customers in the shop, whatever, but if the people who work there don't respect me, then I don't want to be in their store, unquote. Gretch expressed a similar sentiment, explaining that, quote, when I walk in and no one bats an eye, that's a red flag, unquote. Echoing these sentiments, Marina explained that, quote, in places I've been to that don't feel welcoming, it's always a man who's working, and he either ignores customers or ignores female customers, and that kind of reaction makes it uncomfortable to ask for things, unquote. In these examples, we see specifically how employee indifference can make first-time and marginalized customers feel unwelcome. Contrasting these experiences of feeling ignored, many of my respondents discussed the destigmatizing effect of a friendly, helpful staff. Karen described the friendship she has built with a black male employee at her local comic book shop, saying, quote, we're always talking about female titles and female writers, and he's really friendly. He's never treated me any different, quote. Reflecting on the value of his friendliness, Karen went on to explain that she really feels more protected in the space and that she believes he would help her if a male customer tried to harass her. This demonstrates how employees who reach out to customers and establish personal connections can mitigate marginalized customers' feelings of stigma and risk. As a retailer, Anna detailed the ways in which she encourages her employees to reach out. Quote, I make sure the staff greets everyone as soon as they come in and don't treat anyone different. Ask them what they want, help them out, don't make it hard on them, unquote. Anna acknowledged that most customers decline when offered assistance, but she stressed the importance of offering that help and offering recommendations for new titles when appropriate. In order to help facilitate casual conversation, Anna intentionally decorated her shop with various geeky talking pieces, like a Pac-Man carpet and Doctor Who memorabilia. She hopes that these talking pieces will inspire more reticent customers to open up and form the personal connections to which she aspires. In addition to the behavior of the staff, many of my respondents cited the gender makeup of the staff as a source of comfort or distress. As Alyssa summarized, quote, the people who are in the comic store can affect the people who buy from it, unquote. Several of the respondents commented on the presence of an all-male staff as both a warning flag for discriminatory behavior and a thing to be expected. Quote, "It's kind of just what I've grown up to know, that there's always going to be a guy behind the counter," remarked Michelle. Alyssa believed that homogenous hiring was less the result of blatant sexism and more, quote, "based in being too lazy to understand other viewpoints or too lazy to try to diversify your employee base," unquote. Anna also acknowledged that while she wanted to hire more women in her shop, not many applied. Finally, Michelle described how an all-male staff can affect a woman entering the space. Quote, "The typical shop that I go to down the street is definitely more of a boy zone. There's always guys behind the counter. If there's another person in the store, it's always another guy, and I'm probably the anomaly coming in," unquote. Here, the gender makeup of the staff is mirrored in the gender makeup of the customer base, creating an all-male space in which Michelle feels anomalous. To mitigate the stress of being the only woman in a room full of men, five of my respondents suggested that shops hire women. Gretch explained how, quote, "If there's a woman working there, it's a great quality because it means they understand that they need to appeal to more than just men," unquote. At an Ohioan shop she worked at, Alyssa noticed that, quote, "just having the employee base being female really opens the store up to people who are just now looking to get into comics," unquote. In Alyssa's experience, having an abundance of female employees makes first-time readers feel more comfortable regardless of the customer's gender. The more female employees present, the better, but any number of women is helpful to mitigate the stigma of being the only woman in a shop. While the shop she visits now has an all-male staff, Karen fondly remembered the woman who worked at her old shop and how great it was to enthuse with her. Courtney summarized this feeling succinctly, saying that, quote, "When comic book shops employ women, I feel more comfortable." I feel it is important to note that, while the presence of female staff members helps mitigate the stigma of being a woman in a comic book shop, Anna and Karen suggested that the behavior of the staff is more important than the gender makeup. As previously mentioned, Anna tried to get more women on her staff, but struggled to find female applicants, and decided to prioritize the cohesion of her staff over its gender representation. Despite being the only woman on the staff, Anna insisted that the diversity, in terms of race, religion, and sexual orientation, on her staff made for a balanced and welcoming team. Karen noted that while the employees at her current shop were all men, this did not stop them from treating her with respect and warmth. Anna and Karen's experiences suggest that while the presence of women on staff is helpful, a majority male staff can still establish the warm and welcoming environment that many women seek in a shop. Along with the behavior and identities of the staff, the content a given shop chooses to sell and display plays a crucial role in the way women experience the space. Five of my respondents described the ways in which seeing hypersexual or objectifying content in a shop made them feel distinctly uncomfortable. Michelle explained how, quote, "If I'm going to see a lot of big-breasted anime or pin-up kind of artistry that's made for guys, that's not going to be cool for me to go in there," unquote. Karen echoed the sentiment, saying that busty or sexy action figures are, quote, "always a big sign," unquote, that a shop will feel exclusive. In her explanation, Courtney distinguished between content that is, quote, "sexy in an empowering way" and "sexy in an objectifying way," unquote. Although she did not outline what features distinguish the two kinds of content from one another, she insists that some sexual images make her feel distinctly less comfortable in space. For some customers, the effect a shop's content has on them can be almost subliminal. Before opening her own shop, Katie frequently felt overwhelmed at the prospect of visiting her local comic book shop. For months, she was unable to understand why visiting the shop, which should have been an enjoyable task, exacerbated her social anxiety. Finally, quote, "I had this realization that the walls were covered in really objectifying and sexualized, uncomfortable posters, and it wasn't what I was buying there. It wasn't targeted at me, but in order to shop there, I had to do this blindering work, to be not actively mad at that. If I was having a bad week, I couldn't do it at all. I would just not go. I wanted it to be a comforting space, and it just wasn't. It was work," unquote. Without realizing it, Katie was exerting a significant amount of emotional effort into blocking these upsetting images from her conscious experience of the store. By displaying this hypersexual content, the shop owners were unintentionally adding an additional barrier to women who wanted to enter their establishment and the fandom at large. Katie explained that the environment this produced was most likely accidental as, quote, 90% of the promotional posters that get sent out, unquote, contain objectifying images. As such, shop owners who hang every promotional poster they're sent may be unintentionally driving female customers away. Beyond the specific problem of objectifying content, several respondents noted that the kinds of comics the shop sells affect their feelings of inclusion within the space. To mitigate these feelings of exclusion, shop owners can focus on selling and displaying a variety of titles and comic genres. Gretch explained how and why her shop prioritizes representation of marginalized groups in the comics they order. Quote, where the average store would order more Superman or Wonder Woman, we're ordering more Black Panther, we're ordering more X-Men titles, we're ordering more Young Justice. We're trying to even out the visibility of these characters so that when customers of color come into the shop, they see them prominently and recognize themselves. Just as seeing someone of the same gender behind a counter can make a woman feel more comfortable in a shop, seeing their marginalized identities reflected in the content of the store can mitigate a customer's feelings of stigma. Carrying diverse content shows that a shop both recognizes the existence of marginalized groups and is invested in promoting their voices. Karen, who identifies as both Chicana and Latina, emphasized the importance of racial representation in the comics she reads, explaining that she is, quote, very much invested in finding other Latino and other Chicana within the media that I consume, unquote. In describing the effects of this symbolic annihilation, Karen referenced the author Juno Diaz, who wrote that without representation in the media, one feels monstrous. Marina told me that being a comic book fan and person of color can be difficult, quote, because I tend not to see myself in the media that I consume, unquote. Thus, by selling a diverse array of comics, shops can make marginalized customers, such as women of color, feel seen and validated within the space, while appealing to their commercial interests. This does not mean that inclusive shops must only sell indie comics, but that they should focus on presenting a variety of stories in addition to the mainstream depictions of white men in capes. Michelle and Katie both outlined the benefits of kid-friendly shops in their interviews. When picking a shop, Michelle factors in whether or not their content is child-appropriate, because she likes to shop for comics with her son. This is not to say that all the comics in the shop are suitable for children, but that the more adult content is kept out of children's reach. In this case, not putting up posters with hypersexual imagery is doubly beneficial, as it makes women feel less uncomfortable and keeps the shop kid-friendly. Additionally, shops can place mature content on the highest shelves while keeping the appropriate books at the eye level of a child. Keeping parents' concerns in mind when arranging your shop can make parents feel more comfortable while increasing the likelihood that they will buy their children comics in addition to their own purchases. Finally, the gender-coded merchandise a shop sells contributes to the larger gendering of the space. In her depiction of a particularly boy-zone shop she visited, Michelle referenced how much sports paraphernalia the shop sold. Since comic books are already masculine-coded in U.S. culture, the addition of more masculine-coded merchandise, such as sports merchandise, can compound feelings of stigma and exclusion for female customers. Courtney argued that the presence of merchandise that, quote, women would be drawn toward, unquote, makes a shop feel more welcoming. Much like the case of representation in comics, finding feminine-coded merchandise could make many feminine customers feel seen and would benefit the retailer by providing an additional means of revenue. The final arena of inclusive practice in comic book shops can be best described as the aesthetics of the shop. The majority of respondents agreed that the classic exclusionary shop was dingy, dark, and dirty. The words dungeon and cave were echoed across interviews. When Anna recalled the state in which she originally found her shop, she summarized the aesthetics of exclusion and inclusion well. Quote, when I bought the shop originally, it was a dark, dank environment. So I was like, okay, take all these posters off the wall. We're painting these walls bright. We need light in here. We're not doing the cave thing. Unquote. Initially, Anna was given the dark, physically unappealing shop. Recognizing that the space was aesthetically unpleasing, Anna transformed the space through her use of posters, paint, and light. For shop owners looking to make their space more inclusive, the tangible steps outlined in this section are the easiest ways to implement inclusive practice. The first step in creating an inclusive aesthetic is maintaining a clean, well-lit shop. Marina said, quote, a majority of the comic book stores I've gone to have felt dingy and feel very masculine and very judgmental, unquote. Since dinginess can code a space as masculine, retailers that work to keep their shops clean and modern can work towards a more gender-neutral space. In their descriptions of inclusive practices, several respondents noted that clean shops are more inviting. One concrete step shop owners can take to make their spaces less exclusionary is taking down or limiting the promotional posters they have on the walls. As Katie's story of the objectifying posters demonstrates, shop owners who hang every promotional poster they receive can unintentionally alienate female customers and first-time readers. Katie outlined the effects posters can have on an unsure customer and how she mitigates these effects in her own shop. Quote, I think that lots and lots of posters is itself not necessarily gendered, but I think it's a sort of gatekeeping, because you have this feeling of, like, this place is full of characters that I've never heard of. This must not be the place for me. Unquote. Without verbally questioning customers' fandom knowledge, an abundance of promotional posters can overwhelm first-time readers, as it visually confronts them with all of the titles they do not know. Similarly, keeping comics in boxes rather than shelves detracts from the comic's physical accessibility and assumes a heightened level of fandom knowledge. Boxes are more suited for people who know exactly what they're looking for, not for first-time readers looking to explore. Anna and Michelle both spoke to the power of a bright paint job. With the right color, a new coat of paint can make the room seem brighter while adding to its visual appeal. In describing a local, particularly inclusive shop, Michelle gave special attention to the orange paint of the awning, which adds to the store's modern and clean aesthetic. Even if a shop is in a particularly shady building or area, a fresh coat of paint can create a sense of brightness and newness. Some of these practices might seem like obvious procedures any business owner would implement. I acknowledge that greeting customers, maintaining a clean environment, and making sure the shop is well-lit are all relatively self-explanatory practices. However, the fact remains that many comic shop owners do not implement these practices. It is necessary to study these practices and the effect that they have on marginalized customers simply because too many retailers are neglecting these basic tenets of business. By implementing these inclusive practices, shop owners can gain the satisfaction of knowing they are engaging previously marginalized customers while reaping economic benefits. Within the realm of the comic book shop, the two most alienating factors are antisocial or competitive male behavior and stereotypical masculine shop aesthetics. When a shop's interior design invokes stereotypes of comic books as a masculine domain, these visual cues remind female customers they are socially trespassing. Visual markers that remind first-time customers of all the fandom knowledge they lack, such as an abundance of promotional posters, can make them question their validity within the space. Finally, when shop employees do not engage with female customers or directly question their fandom knowledge, they invalidate women's membership within the community, potentially leading women to seek out other shops or abandon comics altogether. However, by providing friendly customer service, maintaining a clean working environment, minimizing displays of sexualized content, and selling a diverse array of merchandise, shop owners can help mitigate female customers' feelings of exclusion. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Cindy from Endor. I'm Angelica Kalika from the University of Colorado Boulder, and I'm going to be talking about Spider-Gwen today, finding Spider-Gwen community adventures in their speech and basically looking at the success and saying, like, why is it successful? And I'm doing this through fan interviews. So it will sort of look to categorize what kind of things in the actual text are fans really drawn back to the book each month. It's qualitative research methods. I'm using John Fisk's fan talk, Philipson's speech codes theory, and very similar to what other panelists have talked about today, finding these connections to, like, feminist and millennial identities. So how do spider fan Gwen fans use cultural myths to constitute community? So let's just have a little bit of background on Gwen Stacy. She came in 1965 in Spider-Man number 31. The 2014, we had the Amazing Spider-Man 2 with sort of just this new kind of energy brought. You know, it became in our awareness again. Younger generations are like, okay, let's go look at, you know, some older Spider-Man storylines. I mean, she has popped up through other Spider-Man recreations. She's had clones, those kinds of things. But Jason Latour and Robbie Rodriguez in 2015 really gave her a chance, and she premiered in Spider-Verse. However, her death, though, the most important part about her backstory is her death, as it essentially ended the innocence of the Silver Age in 1973 and brought on this really, like, much grittier age of comic books, the Bronze Age. And so, again, you know, she's bitten by a radioactive spider, just like Peter Parker. And her costume is sort of crazy. Why? Like, first of all, it's beautiful. Second of all, it's essentially unisex, right? We don't see this hypersexualization of the breasts and the buttocks and all of these, you know, it celebrates the female form, but not in a typical way that we've seen in previous comic books. And it has sort of these basic elements of the Spider-Man, and also, you know, because they have some of the webbing, the pink, but look at those shoes. I would totally wear those shoes. I would wear those shoes here, or, you know, going to school. These are, you know, I'm going to kick some butt shoes. These are comfortable. They're not high heels. They're not boots. They're not boots with heels. They're not leather. They're comfortable. And she has really become very successful. In her first run after Spider-Verse, they gave her 5 books. Then after that, now she's on her 25th. So she's had 2 runs in theory. They only wanted to give her 5. But in the past couple of years, it's just done really well. And so now there's cosplay. People wear her hoodie. Men wear her hoodie. You know, this is exciting. She's sort of really allowing a lot of boundaries between these sort of new fans and older fans, you know, to enjoy this kind of content. So let's go a little bit in the nitty-gritty of the academics. Let's talk about the speech codes theory. So this is allowing us, you know, for Philipson to look at how a community is formed. We're going to specifically look at cultural myths. What kind of myths are discussed in these communities through these fan interviews that I conducted? And again, it leads us to, you know, what forms a speech community? What is a speech community? Del Himes, you know, within the realm of ethnography of communication, defined it as, you know, as a community sharing knowledge of rules and conduct and interpretation of speech. I mean, even the San Diego Comic-Con, this can be looked at as a speech community. I mean, literally the word canon right there, right? There's so much text and the way we use language here that's very specific to this localized economy. And so I'm looking at that within just the Spider-Gwen fans. So cultural economy, fan talk, Fitz says, you know, this fan talk, this the way that fans talk among each other, the generation circulation of the object of fandom within a local community, immediate social relationships, localized economy. So again, how do fans talk to each other? How do we talk to each other here? I'm sure you've had some pretty unique conversations just in this building that you probably won't have in your everyday life with your coworkers or your classmates because of sort of this cultural economy of here, of a subordinated and unsubordinated, you know, of official culture and non-official culture. And it, even within here, we have levels of official and unofficial culture, and you know who's a fan and who's not a fan, and all these boundaries, and it's a lot of it's dictated by our language and how we talk. So let's talk a little bit about feminist millennials. You know, the media sensationalizes millennials as a slacker generation. However, this outlook doesn't really accurately showcase the strengths, just like as our other panelists have discussed. You know, this group is the most educated and paid less than their predecessors. By 40, most millennial women will be single. I'm 31. I'm single. They prefer family values over corporate values, and the majority would, you know, consider a career in public service. So, you know, I think they're pretty valuable. They're a valuable generation. And, you know, let's look at the cross-section with feminists. You know, DC's Wonder Woman broke the first barrier with this amazing interpretation of, you know, how a woman can have many roles and portray many other masculine features and feminine features within the first wave, second wave, and third wave. And much everyone says the Wonder Woman was before the first wave, but it sort of was ahead of their time. You know, and so we can also touch on, like, how feminists communicate and, like, you know, what is a possible fourth wave, and is that sort of in Spider-Gwen? You know, is the fourth wave environmentalism, digital communication, those kinds of things? Or collectivists? Okay, so the good part, the findings, right? So out of these interviews, I was able to find five themes that sort of kept coming up about, like, why do they care? Why are they reading this? And what is it about the text that gets them super excited to come back every week? Every month. So the act of reading. So how do they actually go about reading this comic? I mean, this could be a controversial topic for many hardcore comic book fans. Like, I'd be afraid to get in a debate about this, honestly. Right, because is it going to be digital? Is it going to be in print? Do you get the print and then just read the digital? Or, like, how do you go about it? And many of these, they wanted to collect the physical copies. They were excited. They prioritized collecting the Spider-Gwen copies over even Spider-Man. And yes, Spider-Man most of the time got them into reading Spider-Gwen. What really excited them was that it was something that they could look forward to and hold, keep as a collector's item, and then also go online and read digitally. But they were treasuring this. This is something they treasured. For many people, this is something that also brought them back into comics. Like, this was something that allowed them to go into this world. They had perhaps been Spider-Man fans in the past, and they had, you know, been reading Spider-Man or buying Spider-Man on sale, but this is something they would keep on file, and they would pay that, you know, $4.99, $3.99, depending where they could get it from, because it would sell out. This is something they cherished. And it, again, they could have been fans from, you know, the TV shows, Spider-Man fans, and for a couple, it was also the first time they actually purchased a book. So this is bringing back fans that sort of fell away, and this is adding new fans into this community through a female superhero character, which is cool. So there's a lot of visual vocabulary. They discussed a lot of, you know, the art and the style of the costume. They did remark unisex. They remarked over-sexualized. It's not over-sexualized. One person, I quote, under-sexualized. She's an under-sexualized female superhero character. The visual vocabulary creates these tense moments and emotions in readers. One person stressed that the artist and writer takes something they recognize as Marvel canon and then allows Spider-Gwen to experience it in a completely different way. They like the modern art and style, contemporary. Quote, the lettering is very dynamic. The different art style indicates a small story to fill you in. Again, a lot of people use, quote, dynamic. It's thematically, a couple remarked, this is thematically for mature audiences, yet it's appropriate for children. Like, that's the power of visual vocabulary. The power of these panels, the power of the ordering of the panels. They said, quote about the outfit, a young person would incorporate that into a costume. You know, the blue slippers, this is something a modern young person would wear. Someone remarked that the slippers call back to a silver age and that the art is, quote, otherworldly. They did enjoy the guest artists, but they preferred it when it went back to this punk art to help distinguish the energy of the comic. Another theme is twisted characterization. So, you know, so all these characters that come into Spider-Gwen are unique, but most of them have a backstory in Marvel, and they are all twisted, and they have a completely new spin. And this came up as something that drew them back to the text time and time again. Here we have, we have Le Chat Noir, we have Captain America, we have Daredevil. So she is old and yet new again, they remarked. Fans enjoy, you know, having these new storylines. Again, sorry guys, Peter Parker dies. Okay? Just giving that away right now. Dies like in the first two panels. He dies because he was the Lizard. Trying to be cool. Got into some bad stuff. But it lets to go back to a time of Spider-Man without spoiling it, and without spoiling their childhood, someone remarked. That, you know, they want to keep those memories sacred. They don't want to go into the new Spider-Man, reinvented stuff, but this allows them to still enjoy those characters and have a completely new world. Tangentially revisiting the Spider-Man Spider-Man and secondary characters, quote. They really enjoyed Captain America as a female. It was fascinating to watch Le Chat Noir and the Daredevil. He's Kingpin. He's a villain here. He's, like, pretty mean. And he's still blind and, like, really cool. You know, and all of them are redefined. And a quote, one of them said, it doesn't feel cheap. Because people can take our really beloved characters and twist them around to make money off of them, to do something new, and it feels cheap. And you feel cheated as a fan. You feel exploited. And here, the fans said that they didn't feel that. They felt this was taken with care and twisted in a way that they enjoyed it, and that didn't play with their emotions. And I understand that. I understand. Fans want to know, what does she do without her power? You know, as Gwen Stacy is a lot more engaging now, you know, than a girl with a headband, quote. She gets but it's almost like she's taking drugs to get by, quote. Spoiler alert. She loses her powers at some point. And she has to take drugs to get her powers back. I don't like to call them drugs. It's weird, but the fans did. They're boosters. They're green. They glow. They're boosters. But it's a completely different girl. You know, she went from this college girl, very, you know, straightforward, and now she's a kick-ass. So there is also this weird mirror-mirror effect, again, because we're using so many different Marvel characters, and it's not a recycling, it's a twisting. I like to say twisting. And the fans just don't know what's going to happen next, and they just really enjoy it. And they call them, you know, a lot of these twisted characters eye candy. Okay, normal people, what is youth like? You know, fans get to see themselves as Gwen Stacy. She's managing a job and a social life, and that sometimes, as a fan remarked, that sucks, and you fail at it more times than not. fans question, what does a young person do who's struggling to make it in life and balance that with, you know, the mentality of real life and then, you know, the amazingness of her superhero powers. She has a real person's hobby as a drummer in a band. You know, one fan said she's brash and she makes mistakes and too quick decisions. I relate to her as a younger person. Someone said Jason Latour writes her really funny. He's good at understanding young people. These are flawed characters, and we resonate with those because he's had typical issues in our lives. And male fans can relate to what she's going through as well. Okay, and relationships. Okay, this is the best one. This is my favorite one because this talks about the father-daughter relationship, the relationship between her bandmates, and the relationships between her and the villains. Even though the father-daughter relationship is brought up several times by fans, they all really agree that he's an ally who works to support her, but he gets to still treat her as a daughter. This relationship makes fans feel that they know what to expect, but again, it doesn't follow a typical story arc. They stress it also shows how much he cares for her because he literally sacrifices freedom. He goes to jail in order to keep her identity a secret. And a strong father figure for a young female woman is like a huge thing in most popular media. And it's rare. Fans said they can relate to those moments with their own fathers. Fans focused on her relationship with her friends and her bandmates, balancing a really hectic life, the odd relationship between the Green Goblin Harry and her, and how she's being supportive and yet trying to kick his butt at the same time. And the really great student-mentor relationship with Jessica Drew and Captain America, Penny Moon. Those kinds of things, but they said she has a weird relationship with Spider-Ham. Spider-Ham is awesome. He is the pig who is a spider. So let's talk about the conclusion. So is she a feminist millennial? Does this sort of bring people back to the text? You know, there's a social responsibility of being a superhero. Females are human and not just a romantic storyline and can be unisexual. Much of the storyline does not, you know, focus on a romantic relationship at all, even though there's a little bit with Maya Morales, but it's really a friendship. And she's like, hey, you know, let's put that to the side and let's focus on the future. There is, I think, a 90s third wave touching the fourth wave with feminist values. And, you know, these cultural myths are told through the themes. This way of speaking with the fans created a speech community. This fan talk created cultural capital and really elevated their status as a hardcore fan. And the fact that she's a female derivative can transcend, hopefully, into this official culture to show how female superheroes are now becoming more mainstream, even with a subordinated male-dominated popular culture of comic books. And like the panelists were talking about, you know, executives saying that, oh, diversity isn't selling, females aren't selling. Well, they are. And especially when you hire writers and artists that come from those communities, they can speak with an authentic voice. So, thank you.
All right, well, we've got time for questions. If you've got one, raise your hand. Don't be shy.
Do you think it's any coincidence that Gwen is an offshoot of Spider-Man, whereas Spider-Girl, which was recently popular for 100 or so issues, was Peter Parker's daughter? That they choose that venue to travel down rather than inventing some entirely new female character?
I mean, that's what really drew me to the series, because there's so many female derivatives out there, and it's like, why does a woman always have to be attached to a man in some way? But since, I mean, we have She-Hulk, we have a lot of them, and sometimes they're invented just for, you know, capitalizing in marketing. And here, Jason Latour and Robbie Rodriguez really stressed that they put Spider-Gwen in the Spider-Verse series because they wanted a fresh story and they wanted specifically a feminist female and millennial character. That's why I wanted to talk to fans to see, like, are they getting that along? Like, is that what they're getting from the story? Is that what's bringing them back? And it really is. So their intention, even though they aren't, you know, females and they aren't millennials necessarily, I think I looked at their ages, they are able to incorporate a lot of these identities within Spider-Gwen. I hope that answered your question.
Could you define what you mean by millennial? If you could put your millennial mindset hat on, what does feminism mean to millennials?
I don't know if you want to answer the millennial one, but so millennials, it's a broad definition, and depending on what marketing organization you talk to, it's going to be different for each one. So, you know, I'd like to say I'm a millennial. I was born in 85. Some people have it at 82, and essentially it's a generation that a lot of people want to make money off of. They want to know how to tap into it. Why? Because they're doing things differently. They're interacting with the world differently. They're traveling differently. They're spending money differently. They're not having kids early. They are not buying big purchases. They are essentially a generation that is dealing with the realities of our 2008 crash, and also with outlook of environmentalism, an outlook of hope and efficiency. And it's shaking up a lot of industries. I mean, this year, retail alone has really hit hard, unfortunately. But then other industries are sort of kicking up to fill in other niches that millennials want. I guess it depends on what outlook you're looking at for, you know, how to define a millennial generation. And then for feminism, I define feminism as equality. I mean, it's that simple, and that's what I tell my students, too. It's like, it just means equality, and that's it. I mean, there's a lot of subsets. There's a lot of subcultures and there's a lot of studies of feminism, but it's just, you know, everyone being equal. It doesn't necessarily have to be with women's rights. It doesn't have to be with LGBT rights. It's all rights. It's human rights. Yeah, I wanted to get more into that, but then I realized I'm not doing a paper on Wonder Woman. But I think it's fascinating because, so Wonder Woman was, and probably many of you know, she was created by a husband and wife. The husband was a professor, and their goal was to have a really gender-bending female superhero that broke barriers and boundaries and whipping, and, you know, it was very, all of these kinds of things that you read into it, you can get into so much amazing Wonder Woman lore and history and research out there, but it came before its time. Like, the first wave did not happen, really. It happened like, I think, 10 or 20 years later after Wonder Woman first premiered. And so that's why I think Wonder Woman is a good marker for the first time we see feminism in comics, not necessarily feminism in a broader popular culture sense.
It's like the first wave of comics feminism.
Yeah.
Hey.
Okay, gotcha.
You just invented that. I like it.
I've actually got a question kind of for all of you. I don't know if you're on the Comic Scholars listserv, but in the last few days, and obviously, of course, you've been having all this time to check the listserv while you've been at Comic-Con, but there's been this ongoing discussion. I guess I want to say Jim Lee said some remarks somewhere about how the comics industry is, you know, like the sales are way down and the whole thing is doomed to failure, et cetera, et cetera. And this is, of course, you know, a doomsday scenario that is, you know, has been raised over and over and over again for the last 20 years.
But one of the things I was thinking about is how I was thinking about those, and I was thinking about the comments from like Marvel Marketing, which actually happened at WonderCon in the spring while I was at WonderCon, about how, you know, the retailers were saying they weren't selling these diverse books and they didn't want to see these diverse books. And I was wondering if you could comment some about like the ways in which millennials, and particularly female millennials, and their engagement in characters like Ms. Marvel, like Spider-Gwen, like are changing and transforming the industry, right, and the way that like comics get sold. Because, of course, one of the conversations that's surrounding the Comic Scholars Listserv discussion of the tanking of the industry is that getting actual sales figures to find out how much comics are selling is really difficult. So.
Yeah, sure, I can. Part of my paper that I didn't really actually talk about in the discussion was about marketing to millennials and what millennials are looking for, and how basically, even though this is a book like for millennials, they're still trying to sell it. And so how do they like sneak it into the book to sell? And a lot of the things that the statistics and the research was saying is that millennials are super loyal to very specific niches. Instead of like, if you're trying to sell to millennials or trying to hire millennials, they kind of aren't necessarily loyal to big companies. They're not necessarily loyal to their employer, but they're loyal to their position. They want to do a good job at the position they're doing. If they find a good product that they like, they're going to be more likely to tell their friends about the product, but not necessarily other products that the same company makes. And I feel like with comic books in the past, especially with like the big two, there kind of has been a loyalty, like people are either DC or Marvel. And obviously they're pretty loyal to their favorite superhero and their favorite book and stuff. But you can, in the past, there have been like just huge camps, like I prefer DC, I prefer Marvel, and anymore that's not really the case. A lot of the millennials are just really loyal to their one book, or they're really loyal to their writers that they like. And obviously this isn't like new, this has always been going on, but there's just been a spike in this type of loyalty in the market. That answers the question.
And I really like how you stress that it is really hard to track sales, and it's really hard to understand your audience, because nobody wants to really put the money into doing it, or they just don't care. I feel that the future is bright because I am a Disney fan. I know it's controversial. I love Simpsons. But Disney bought Marvel, and I feel that Disney is really on a good path of incorporating a lot more, not diversity just in their characters, but in their staffs. And I think once we have that, more diversity in our staffs, more diversity in Marvel offices, it's going to show through, it's going to bleed into the content. And again, how do you track these sales? How do you see if this works or not? I'm hoping, you know, the Disney marketing team is going to sort of step up that game as well, and really apply sort of their whole branding scheme and formulations to the Marvel world, and beyond creating a Tsum-Tsum of Spider-Man.
I think too, now it's like way easier, obviously, to read the comics illegally, and so you can't necessarily gauge how many people are reading it. It might be super popular, and that means like later, if you release merchandise or you release a movie or something, people are going to go pay to see that or pay to get the merchandise, but they're not necessarily going to pay for the book. Mm-hmm. Because they can read it illegally. And yeah, $4 isn't a lot like in one, but obviously everyone has like 30 books they want to get every month, and to continue it, it's a big price eventually. But
it also seems too like a lot of people are buying stuff in trades, and that the trade sales, not only are they not like being successfully tracked, but they're not having an effect on the books themselves, because the trades come out so much later that the publishers have already made their decisions about whether a book is selling well or not. And that actually gets into a question that I wanted to ask Caitlin about, whether she'd asked questions of these people about how the effect of what's being stocked, like comic-wise, like book-wise. I know my comic shop, like, it's not at all kind of off-putting in a gender way, like, or at least not overtly, and, like, the people who run it are, like, it's mostly this, like, I don't know, 60-year-old lady who's very nice, but doesn't really know anything about comics. And so she just stocks, like, Marvel and DC, so it's stuff like, I'll be like, could you maybe carry Bitch Planet for me? And she's like, people keep asking me about that one, is it good? You know, it's like Image, it's just not on the shelves. And those are the titles that seem to draw, have been drawing a large female audience. So did you ask any questions of your peeps about that?
A little bit, but I didn't want to focus on the text so much. I was more about their experiences as fans. But one of my respondents, who is a retailer, got into the business having no interest in comics herself. So it's kind of like the owner, it sounds like, but she is, like, dedicated to figuring out what people want to be reading. And that kind of, the not knowing what people want to read is kind of the part of the broader issue. Is you have shop owners who get into the business because they just want kind of a personal collection, and they're more interested in what they want than what sells, or you have someone who doesn't totally know what they should be stocking, and they're not doing that research, and that can that creates these environments where people aren't getting what they want and what could get them into comics. I don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah.
I think what's exciting for me is that I go to Charles and Second to buy a lot of my comic books, and it's this place where there's a cross-section of film, TV, DVDs, books, and I like how they look at what their fans are purchasing. They're really good at tracking it, and then they market it very heavily and with the merchandise. So I'm like, okay, is this something Disney's going to do? Can I walk into a Disney store and then get my Marvel comics with my Marvel toys? Will my Marvel comics be free at some point? Because those are the brand, that's the branding, that's the stylistic. Will I buy a toy and then I'll get a free digital code that goes to a free book that month? I don't know where it's going, but it feels like there's definitely convergence of, you know, content with, you know, selling merchandise, which Disney's very, very good at.
Everyone should shop at that store because they sometimes don't know about comics, and they sell really good variants there for, like, cheap.
Yeah.
I'll just keep asking questions if you guys don't pipe up. Yeah, go ahead.
The woman that did this study about the comic book spaces being masculine and stuff, you described the case of a female shop owner had difficulty finding female employees. Why do you think that is? What's the underlying cause of that difficulty?
I think, like I said, it's in, like, U.S. culture, comics tend to be masculinely coded, and so, like, there's that barrier already when people think, like, what jobs am I going to apply for? And so there's kind of a potential lack of interest or a feeling that they wouldn't be qualified for the job. I don't totally know because that wasn't the specific scope of my study, there is, like, a kind of lack of people applying for that job, but like I said in the presentation, that's not, like, an end-all. There's still plenty of ways to create inclusivity in a shop, even if you don't have any women employees, so that's not end of days.
Yeah, it's a fascinating point about the paint job. It's so true.
Yeah.
Well, Angela, I was wondering, did you do, like, kind of field research? Did you have, like, people that you talked to about the Ms. Marvel connection?
No, I was looking at, well, no, not specifically, but what I did look at was fan letters, a bunch of fan letters that they included in the books, and a lot of the readers, which I thought this was just, like, interesting, but a lot of the readers were specifically writing in, like, you think it would be people like, oh, finally a character like me, but it was actually, like, there's one, it was like, I'm a white Mormon guy. I love this book because I love seeing representation, positive representations of religion within the comic book. And obviously there were, like, a lot of teenage girls who liked it and stuff, but a lot of guys were writing in and just saying this book is really fresh and we like this book because we relate to it, even though on the surface it wouldn't appear that they would. But I think that's why G. Will Wilson is awesome, because she codes it on different levels of, like, relatability, where on the surface a lot of people can look at this and say, that is literally me, and a lot of people are like, I'm not like that at all, but I really do like bacon, and I want that bacon sandwich like she does. So I kind of looked at it at like that, but other than that, what I really did was look at statistics of perceptions of millennials, and there wasn't that much research out there yet. The study I looked at mainly was from 2016, and it too looked about perceptions of millennials in the media and like the mature media, like news and stuff, and there really is like zero representations for millennials in like news media, and so this is why it's creating this perception that, and then creates distance between the generations, because if you look on the news or something, the telecasters there talking about things that millennials find in, like important in their lives, like student debt, higher education, that kind of thing, and they never have any millennials on to talk about it, despite the fact that the oldest millennials are almost 40. And clearly, many are probably qualified enough to talk about it. But the only representation in these like mature media is they're making fun of millennials. Like CNN doesn't actually do that much with millennials, but Fox does a lot of stuff about millennials. And usually, they are interviewing the ones on the street, and they're not. They only obviously are including the ones that seem silly or immature, obviously to prove some kind of point, probably. But
yeah, I think in Denver, where Angela and I are from, Denver Boulder, they have a whole marketing campaign with our first bank, and it was all about dissing millennials and making fun of the man bun, and that we're lazy and that we don't do anything, we don't work very hard, and they saw that it was killing their business, like it was really hurting them, and they're like, oh my gosh, let's completely flip the script. And so now they're doing these commercials about this grandpa and this whole economy of sharing, and he was sharing his pants with a millennial so he could get help on an app, or you know, so they're trying to sort of now, like, they're seeing like, no, we need to engage millennials, and we need to do it in a positive manner, because they don't like being made fun of, and they're hardworking, and you know, they deserve the same kind of respect previous generations have gone.
Well, Angelica, you mentioned talking about Spider-Gwen, that one of the draws for audiences was the kind of dynamism of the art and the differences of the art style. And Caitlin, you were talking about how those posters would be off-putting. It was making me think, I was working on an article on Captain America in the last couple of weeks, which led me to reading the Heroes Reborn stuff from the 90s when Rob Liefeld was drawing Cap, and I was just, I'm just going to say it was not my favorite comic series I've ever engaged with. And so I was wondering maybe if part of the like appeal of these books that do have such an appeal towards millennials and towards female millennials is the fact that they tend to be different from what one thinks of as traditional comic art style, and very different from like that kind of hyper-masculinized image styles of the 90s.
Yeah, I totally agree, because, I mean, if you guys think back, I mean, even just look at X-Men in the 90s, I mean, that was, they're just ripped. These people were just amazing. They didn't exist in real life. They couldn't exist in real life. But this art style, these people can exist in real life. I can wear shoes like that and be a superhero at the same time. It's exciting. I would totally wear this outfit and like jump around. You know, I don't know if I want to like hurt people, but I would jump around. And it's also very, it's a very stylistic. Robbie Rodriguez in multiple interviews was saying how much energy it takes, and literally that he might be quitting at some point, because to do a book of this kind of this magnitude, this kind of style, and it's an art form within a month is extremely taxing, and plus he has some of his own side projects. But it's a lot of them have said this is like a punk art, and this is another. It's a complete, almost its own genre of art, where we have a lot of these neon colors and these sort of fresh styles and panels that sort of collide and mesh in a really unique way. And it's a style that's essentially carried through the series, as long as there's not a guest artist or like a dream sequence with a guest artist. A lot of the fans didn't like the interruption kind of thing, but it's not. It's not feminine necessarily, right? Just because it's not masculine doesn't mean it's completely feminine. It's just its own. It's its own thing. Its own punk.
Yeah,
and again, I didn't focus too much on text with my respondents, but when they did talk about stories that they're drawn to, a lot of them spoke about stories above all else. And so I think for them, like lines that are more about the story and presenting a new take, a new narrative, are going to be more interesting than those that are more focused on like skin tight suits or more stereotypical stories that we've heard before that are tired and over sexualized.
All right, we have time for one last question if there's one. Still shy? All right, well, I'd like to thank our panelists again. Stick around, and in 15 minutes, we've got another one.